This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Well, this is one of the more unusual starts to a programme for Out of Doors. I'm Ewan McElraith, and over the other side of this bridge, this echoey bridge, is Mark Stephen. And it's suddenly got echoey because this is the bridge at Hart Hill that goes over the motorway. You come outside and suddenly you're enclosed in glass. It's a strange experience.
It does sound kind of weird, doesn't it? I take it you came from the Glasgow side?
Yep.
Right, just to explain the situation here. A few weeks ago, I was having dinner with some friends of mine, and somebody said the dreaded line, "You'll know the answer to this," which is always a bad start. The question was, where is the heart of Scotland?
Yeah,
difficult. That's not an easy one.
No, I would say you would know the heart of Midlothian. Just to explain, we've come out of the tunnel now, we're just at the side of the motorway, completely different kind of feeling and sound to it.
Well, I thought this would be a good place to start, because Hart Hill Services is the only place I know of in Scotland that has the brass neck to put on a big sign saying, "The Heart of Scotland."
Must be reasonably the heart of Scotland.
It's kind of halfway in the central belt, but where is the heart of Scotland? To my mind, there's got to be an answer to this, whether it's a geographical answer or a historical answer or even a geological answer. Scientifically, mathematically, there's got to be a heart of Scotland, but where is it?
Here. I don't know. There's got to be many hearts.
Uh-huh. Well, say I did the scientific side. Why don't you do the aesthetic side?
The romantic heart.
The romantic heart.
Exactly.
Well, there's got to be many different hearts. It could be quite fascinating.
Yeah.
Well, say we start off here. Let me think. If my theory is correct about where the heart of Scotland is, on this map here, join me here at this point, say in exactly a week's time.
Is that another heart of Scotland, potentially?
I think, personally, this is it, but I'm not nailing my colours to the mast yet.
OK, well, you go over the bridge and I'll go this way, and I'll see you in a week.
Bye-bye.
Let the dance begin.
Hi, my name is Mike Robinson. I'm the Chief Executive of the Royal Scottish Geographical Society based in Perth. And obviously this issue about the geographical heart of Scotland is an interesting one. It's not entirely straightforward to answer. There's a very simplistic way to look at it, which is anybody could do at home, actually, which is where you take the most southerly, westerly, you know, northerly and easterly points and just draw a rectangle around them and roughly find the midpoint, and that will take you to roundabout Aberfeldy, which is approximately the geographical heart. But reality is that there's lots of different issues that you need to take into account. So do you bother to take into account Rockall, which is part of Scotland? But if you do, the geographical heart of Scotland is somewhere just west of the Western Isles.
Wet.
It's very wet. And it doesn't feel very hearty. So it does depend, and also, of course, if you bring in Orkney and Shetland,
You've got to bring in Orkney and Shetland. They're part of Scotland, surely.
Of course you have, aye. Uh-huh. So it's actually to try and find a sort of point and say that is absolutely the heart. If you include the Western Isles, Orkney, Shetland, even St Kilda, of course, that would take you way up to, you know, near Ullapool. So, again, not where people might naturally think the heart would be. So there's lots of other parameters, and it isn't quite as straightforward as I've made out. You can't just draw a rectangle. There are lots of issues that you have to lay on board, like, for example, are you looking at Scotland at the high tide mark? Actually, how do you...
I hadn't thought of that.
How do you... Also, you have to accommodate for the curvature of the Earth as well. Uh-huh. You know, you're looking at sort of... adjusting it for gravity as well, which is what the OS did actually when they actually took a geographical heart. So even they report too, there's a sort of physical heart which is just near Schiehallion, and then there's another one which is adjusted for gravity, which is a wee bit further north between Blairathal and Dalwhinnie. So again, it is a little bit of a difficult thing to pin down.
Somebody tried explaining to me one time something they had carried out, that they'd made a map of mainland Scotland and then cut it out in cardboard, and then tried to balance it on a pin, which sounded vaguely biblical to me, but, you know, that wasn't an attempt to find it. It was a sort of centre of gravity. I can't remember where that was.
That's a lovely idea, if you could be bothered.
You're incredibly bored.
My goodness, you'd have to have a really sharp pair of scissors for that. But again, for mainland, I mean, it is the mainland I'm talking about when we're talking about this area east of Schiehallion. That really is probably going to be the same sort of point, but... Actually, you're talking about... I mean, the cardboard would have to be pretty accurate, wouldn't it? But to get that to balance appropriately, yeah, you're looking at a sort of a weight centre, aren't you? Mm-hmm. If you could be bothered, that's an incredibly... a lot of effort. I have to congratulate them. I've no idea where it would end up, but I imagine it wouldn't be that far away from...
And how detailed you could actually do it, because, I mean, it's to paraphrase Hitchhiker's Guide, all the crinkly bits down the west coast, it'd be difficult to get that accurate.
Very, very hard, yeah. I mean, scientifically, probably the easiest thing to do is take the coordinates and actually work it out scientifically using the difference in the coordinates.
Is this a question that makes any sense to a geographer at all, or is it just whimsy?
It's
all right if it's whimsy, I don't mind,
not,
you know.
But. It's not hugely important to people's lives, but actually there's a lot of these sort of goals, these geographical goals, there's an element of artifice in it, if you like, or there's some points seem very arbitrary. I mean, the magnetic poles move all the time. There's a geographical pole, and actually, I've met plenty of explorers, and they talk about having been to the 3, 6, 9, 11 poles. There are lots of different poles depending on how you look at it, and a lot of geographical quests, very famous geographical quests, have been to what seem arbitrary points, but they're the farthest.
Such as?
Well, things like the most landlocked place in Asia, and or any continent, which place is furthest from the sea in every continent. Mm. And every one of them has been set a challenge. Somebody's gone and done it somewhere, you know. There's lots of these sorts of challenges out there.
Lowest point on Earth, highest point on Earth, driest, wettest, yep. Hottest, coldest, that kind of stuff.
All of the above, yes. Yeah. Actually, the map I want to create for Scotland is a map of travel time to different places. Partly for whimsy, I'll be honest, because I think it would be a really interesting map to plot, because obviously places that you can't... It would either be by car or foot or ferry. But actually, it would be quite a meaningful map in lots of ways, because people do get confused about how long it takes to travel from one place to another. So to actually plot a map of Scotland by time would be a really interesting exercise.
I think it'd be a fascinating exercise. That hadn't crossed my mind before, but if somebody's snipping off the heat of the road... I know that if I go to the Borders, or if I go to certain areas of Fife, say it's 23 miles between point A and point B, you double it. It's going to take you 46 minutes one way or another, you know.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're doing 23 miles in lots of areas where there's motorways or A-class roads, etc., you're probably talking roughly the same number of minutes. That's a really interesting idea.
Well, that's where I think mapping gets really fun, because... I'll be honest, it just seemed like a good thing to do, a fun thing to do. And I think we are going to try and set a challenge to some of our members to come up with a suitable map. But actually, I was talking to some friends at a reps, and of course they're constantly being asked to, on your way down from Inverness, could you pop into Dumfries or something, you know?
Yeah.
And actually, it's quite
common on the BBC too, actually.
Well, there you go. Practical purpose after all. So a lot of these maps do, you know, you can map anything in any way you like. but the best ones tell you something useful.
Okay, Chief Executive, Royal Scottish Geographical Society, if you had to pick one heart of Scotland, where would it be?
That's not fair.
Of course it's not fair. I'm not here to be fair.
I'm going to pick two. The geographical heart of Scotland, a heart suggests passion and involvement and engagement, and therefore, obviously, I'm going to pick our headquarters, our centre in Perth, because it's open to the public, it's there to inspire people about geography. So that is obviously my first answer. But physically, the geographical heart of Scotland, I would settle for the 5 kilometres east of Schehallion, just above Aberfeldy. That's probably as good as you're going to get. Mainland Scotland. It's very difficult to do if you bring the islands in, largely because of rock all.
I'm Jess Smith, and I'm part of the travelling people of Scotland. My mother's folk were Argyllshire, and I have a strong connection to this land. My mother and all her people lived and died in Argyllshire, and the culture of the travelling people is so important to me, and everything and anything that relates to it has really become a passion.
Now, just up here, we've got a very special place in the Tinker tradition. We're just on the edge of the 8815, coming up for Stracker up to rest and be thankful. Looking behind us, you've got Inveraray away in the distance, Lough Fyne looking like glass at the moment. It's a great wee place, isn't it?
Oh, it's beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. We are fortunate, really, in Scotland to have places like this.
And we've moved off the kind of muddy track and we're onto an old road now. And this is quite significant, this road.
It is. This is the 8815, and it's for the junction with the Hells Glen junction, where travellers used to come, where the Tinker folk used to come constantly.
So you've got the three roads meeting here. You've got Hells Glen, which is kind of back road round the rest, and be thankful. We've got Inveraray, away around the coast, and Dunoon, just down the road. And the three roads meet here, and it's got a special significance for you and for the Tinkers.
Yes, because this is where they got married. This is the connection to the land, to the travelling people, the Tinker people, because this was and this is the Tinker's heart of Argyll.
And it's very, very special, because as far as I understand, it's the only real sacred place left for the Tinker.
It's all we have. We didn't have churches, we weren't acceptable in churches, but we were always on the move, we had our seasonal places to go. And churches and ministers and or priests didn't feature in our life, but we were very religious. We still are very religious.
And we've got up here. Now, it's just off the road, about 40 feet off the road. And we got a black fence, a triangular fence. And set in the tarmac, we've got some quartz crystal in the shape of a heart. There's a lot of coins in it as well. We'll come on to that in a minute. But talk me through the heart. What's going on here?
The heart's ancient. Nobody actually knows how old it is. It's several quartz stones that have been embedded in the earth. And even before the construction of roads here, and that was in 1808, no one interfered with the heart. It was sacred. And, the local people and the Tinker people, they wove through each other as the seasons predicted. And the little heart was sacred to them. And the mere fact that it has survived proves that the locals also looked after the little heart.
Now, there's a story about the quartz stones. I'm just wondering, there's about 25, 30 quartz stones about the size of a big cricket ball set into the earth. There's symbolism within the quartz as well.
Well, they say that the young men or the lads who fought and died or were imprisoned or sent to the colonies from this area, the Cowell area, they never come back. And each stone represents each of those lives lost and put there by members of their family or their wives or mothers or whoever. And this is the sacred link to the Tinker people.
So would this mean the time of Culloden?
Well, this is after Culloden. It was just after then that they started to clear the Highlands as well, you know, and there was a terrible time of murder and destroying people's life. And the culture and the Gaelic and everything like that was now becoming, had to hide underground. And people came here because it was the link to their roots, to the earth, to Scotland, to Gaelshire, to actually get married or just to, you know, have the baby christened or the old body blessed.
So there would be bodies, would they bury them around here as well?
Indeed. You know, I mean, when you go back through time, churchyards only have a few bodies in them. You know, there's millions of people have lived and died, but no one can actually find the remains. This is a sacred place. This heart signifies the entire area and how precious it was to the Tinker folks.
I'm a bit naive, but how would folk have found out that a wedding was going to take place?
Well, it's like everything else, you know, the oral tradition. What did we do before telephones and even the post? You know, it was just people knew, young lads, young 12-year-olds, you know, they'd be given the job, you know, just get yourself running, here's a wee pack, take this information and go away and give it to the farmer's wife at such and such a place and go and tell this one and that. And they might meet some other folks here, right, here's a bit of information, go and take it, you've got to take it. I mean, I think it was set, you know, there wasn't any, might happen, it might not. People actually had to get a piece of information from place to place. Balladeers did that, you know, and the Tinkers, the great balladeers, the Stuarts of Blair and Jeannie Robertson and from Aberdeen. This was what they did. You give them a piece of information and if it had to be taken to a certain area, then that information went into verse and then maybe tune so that they could remember it over and over and over again. And in that way, you know, the information was relayed as truthfully as it could be to the recipient.
If you weren't welcome in churches, how did they get married? And did the minister come and do it on the quiet?
There was a minister from Lough Goilhead called the Reverend John McCorkindale, and he would officiate weddings and baptismals and burials here at the Heart. So he looked upon, this is a man who actually worked within a church, you know, he actually recognised the importance of this place. So what was there previous to that? This is what I would like to know. How sacred and how old is this place? You know, it's, you can actually see right here, there has to be a significance. The roads, even the laying of the white quartz stones, you will see that in many, many places in the world. You see in the First World War, where the Canadians, you know, and you get fields and fields of battlefields of mud, yet you'll come across a little grave, you know, with a stick in it and then a helmet on it and, you know, an array of white quartz stones. There is a sacred symbolism to quartz, the white quartz, so that this would also signify the connection to the history of not just the Tinkers, but to the Scottish people who were oralists, who didn't write anything down, they just went from place to place, and everything, as we say, was mouth, you know. Even the pipe music was taught to the wee laddies by the Cantarach, you know. There was no sheets of music and academies to go and learn anything. It came from the heart, didn't come from the head. Hadri hadri hate and tail habidum takum takum dai. The pipes were taught from the mouth. Every single piece of information, people born, people married, people died, was on the tongue, you know. That's how it's actually survived.
Do you get the feeling this may well be pre-Christian, this site, pagan site, Celtic site? Because it is tremendous. Why wouldn't you? It just, I don't know, I'm romanticising a wee bit, but I came down here on my own, and you come off the road and you look at that and you go, wow, and you just kind of chest swells a wee bit.
Yeah.
Special place.
A special place, and the view itself is special because the memory, you know, the memory. No, I mean, the Heart, if it was anywhere at all, you would say, well, I got married at the Heart. But when you visualise it, you know, and see that behind you, the loch, and then the history of this area and how it suffered at certain times through history, perhaps going way, way back to the Celtic times, who knows? I mean, what is religion if it's not what ticks in your heart about how to be good and bad? You know, that is really all it is. But this is a very, very important place.
where is the heart of Scotland? Now, it's a quest that is taking us to some very surprising places, not least this next one, a lonely spot on the South Lanarkshire Moors.
Ah, Mark, looks like we're on the right track now, because that is the sign for the monument.
It's kind of been guesswork up to this stage. It says, Auchengillich Monument, full of the white waymark posts. Walking up here through moorland, with quite a lot of conifer plantation around about it, with Dr. Mark Jordan. Because obviously you can't look for the heart of Scotland without looking for the historic heart of Scotland. And I'd have to say, if I'd had to guess which one you would have gone for, it wouldn't have been this. Why this one?
I chose this site at Auchengillich because, well, I could have chosen somewhere in Perthshire, I could have chosen somewhere in the heart of the Kingdom of Alba, I could have chosen somewhere like Bannockburn with all the historical resonances. But those are really the histories of great power, great kings and battles and things. And what I thought about when I thought about what the heart of Scotland was where popular protest began, where the difficult, if you wish, the carnapsious side of Scottish identity comes from, where the idea that we're all sort of Democrats, we're all Jock Tamson's bairns, where that comes from. And this led me to think about Auchengillich, because this is where the Covenanters really started off popular protest in Scotland, which was extremely radical and verging on something quite modern in terms of they elected the people who met here. They held a sort of parliament in the wilderness. And that, to me, it's like St Kilda's Parliament. You think of that famous image of the folk sitting in St Kilda. But here they met out in this moorland, in the middle of nowhere between, you know, Lanarkshire and Ayrshire. There's a glen with a monument. And that is what, you know, we're going to go and walk towards and see.
A lot of people, and I'm probably one of them, you know, are under possibly the illusion that they know what the Covenanting times were about.
Yes.
And there are some people who are seriously obsessed by it. Summarise it for me. Give me a potted history.
Well, there's two kinds of Covenanters. There's the Covenanters when they were in power, and there's the Covenanters when they're out of power in the 1680s. And in the 1680s, they had lost at the Battle of Bothwell Bridge. Their movement was more or less defeated, but they'd had a massive argument over whether they should recognise the authority of the king. And so they resolved that in 1680, up here at Auchengillich and places like that, that they decided to reject the authority of the king and that they effectively set up their own state in the wilderness where they had their own parliament. They didn't recognise the laws of the king or the Privy Council or parliament or anything. They only recognised their own authority, and they did it in the name of everyone else, in the name of the people.
So this essentially was a political movement more than a religious-based one.
In the 17th century, they don't differentiate between the two.
Yeah.
It is very political in terms of what it is that it's aiming to achieve, which is really a covenanted settlement of Scotland, which is a religious settlement.
Mm-hmm.
But what that settlement meant, in practical terms, was powers extended down to ordinary farmers, not just the great nobles. Power was not something that was held by those who had property. Power was held by the godly. And the godly, if you wish, were as numerous, if not perhaps more numerous, than the people who actually ran Scotland. Scotland wasn't a very democratic place in the late 17th century. There weren't elections, not many people got to vote. You had to own property and your vote was inherited. There was about 3,000 voters.
It's often said that one of the fundamental differences historically between Scotland and England is that Scotland really never had a middle class.
Well, it did. It had the middling sort.
Yeah.
And its nobles and lairds were not that far above the people.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a more cohesive society in that sense. It wasn't so stretched. However, it was a society which was deeply ingrained with its traditions, that those in charge were naturally in charge and had a right to decide what happened in the state, decide what happened in the name of the people. And what the radical Covenanters of the 1680s did was they challenged their authority to say that. They challenged the authority of these people to decide what went on in church, what went on in the state, because they rejected their authority on the basis of biblical interpretation, constitutional interpretation. They said that they were living under a tyranny, so they rejected everything as ungodly in connection with that tyranny.
Mm-hmm.
And out here in the wilderness, they could meet in purity and have their own state, effectively.
I'm trying to just envisage the wilderness at the moment. It's difficult because behind us we've got a big wind farm.
Yeah.
We are surrounded by commercial forestry, which is probably, I don't know, 40 years old tops, I would say.
Yeah.
So you try and imagine this without the trees.
Yeah.
It's not blasted heath, but it's not terrain I would want to drive troopers over in an attempt to sort out some upstarts. It would be difficult.
It was very hard for the government to root out these people because they did deliberately meet in boundary areas, in wildernesses and moors and in the hills. And the terrain up here is boggy, almost impossible to use troops in to hunt these people. Mm-hmm. Because they were also using the terrain to keep away from the troops. You could see the troops coming a long way off. As you can see, there's sort of heather and folds in the land, and it's fantastic places to hide. It looks very open, but actually when you get up close, there's a million and one places you can hide out here. If you look at the map of the south of Scotland, there's vast, empty tracts of land between places. The places that we never really go. And it's up in these moors and on these hills that you come to the landscape that the Covenanters like to inhabit when they wanted to avoid the government.
Just passing Ellen's Isle in Loch Katrine. It's a bit of a blustery day, and Ellen's Isle was where Walter Scott spent a lot of his time riding on the beach, the Silver Strand, which unfortunately when Glasgow wanted to improve its water supply, they put a dam in here, raised it 17 feet and the beach is gone. But it was here that arguably Scott set alight the tourist industry in Scotland when he wrote The Lady of the Lake. I've got my own copy here, it's 1890, but he wrote the book obviously 50 years earlier. Harp of the north, that mouldering long hast hung on the witch elm that shades St. Fillian's spring, and down the fitful breeze thy numbers fling, till envious ivy did around thee cling.
My name's Thomas Allen. I'm a boatmaster in Loch Katrine. I serve in both vessels, the steamship Sir Walter Scott and also the Lady of the Lake, which was formerly known as the Pride of the Clyde. We're now in Loch Katrine in the Trossachs area. We're on Glasgow's principal supply of drinking water.
And more importantly, we're on a steamboat.
Yep, the steamship Sir Walter Scott, who was built by William Denny Brothers of Dumbarton, and she was actually shipped up here in sections up through Loch Lomond. Eventually she ended up at Inversnaid. From Inversnaid she was taken by horse-drawn wagon over towards Stronachlacker and reassembled and launched onto the loch on the 13th of October 1899.
Now, programme involving harts. There are many harts in Scotland, as we've heard already. There's a geographical heart. But when you think about romance, a romantic heart, some people maybe think about the Western Isles, some people maybe think Gretna Green. But me, like many, would see the Trossachs and probably more importantly Loch Katrine as the romantic heart. Would you go along with that?
Yes, I certainly would, especially as it is steeped in history. The romantic part of Loch Katrine is basically the steamship Sir Walter Scott, the vessel you're on today, and also it reflects on the love of the place. People come back time and time again. We've had people married on the steamship Sir Walter Scott. And we had a couple who came back after 40 years to celebrate their anniversary on this very vessel. That was this year.
Well, why though? What was it special about it? I mean, it's just a steamboat and it's just a bit of water.
It's a very quiet place. It's tranquil. People come here from all over the world basically to see Loch Katrine. It's a beautiful bit of countryside. It's steeped in romance.
And poetry as well.
So Walter Scott, he's written a piece of poetry and that is a personal favourite of mine. Skippering on the loch every day, and it's called My Native Land. Breathes there the man with soul so dead, who never to himself have said, this is my own, my native land, whose heart have near within him burned. As home his footsteps here turned, from wandering on a foreign strand, if such there breathe, go mark him well, for him no minstrel rapture swell. How though his titles proud his name, boundless his wealth, as wish can claim. Despite those titles, power and pelf, the rich consented, all in self. Living shall forfeit fair renown, and doubly dying shall go down to the vile dust from whence he sprung, unwept, unhonoured, and unsung.
We've just come off the head of Lough now, and this is the other real romantic heart of Lough Katrine, because this is the birthplace of Rob Roy MacGregor, the hero of many films. Not a major player in the book Rob Roy, but hugely successful, and once again really captured the imagination and went into the bestsellers list in Scotland. Truly an amazing publishing phenomenon. And he was born up at the top of the loch here in 1671. And it really is a magical place, just a wee bit from Glasgow, but transported. Well, that's the romantic side, the maid of the loch side of the heart of Scotland. But is it justified? Was Sir Walter Scott a romantic at heart? Well, to find out, I'm going up to Aberdeen.
I'm Alison Lumsden from the Walter Scott Research Centre at the University of Aberdeen.
Alison, I'm sitting here, come back from the Trossachs. I've got my Lady of the Lake, my copy, and I've got my copy of Rob Roy. And I, probably like millions of others, associate these two books with romance and the dramatic scenery of the Trossachs. Am I, like millions, a bit deluded?
Well, for many readers, that was very much part of their appeal. And there's no doubt that the number of tourists going to Lough Katrine and going to the Trossachs dramatically increased after Scott had written The Lady of the Lake. So clearly it appealed to people's imagination, and they wanted to go and see the scenery against which the poem had been set. But I think one of the key things about Scott's work is that it's always a lot more complex than people imagine it to be. So in The Lady of the Lake, for example, there are very complex political dynamics going on. There's a tension between James V's desire to pacify the Highlands and the Highlands' desire to retain their own culture. So it's far more complicated than people imagine.
And he was a bit worried about the whether his characters... He wanted to have an impressive poem, not just a kind of a pretty thing.
Yes, but I think for Scott, part of writing an impressive poem was also writing a poem in an impressive form. So it's not just about what the poem's about, it's the structure of the poem, the way in which he can use romance structures and reconvene them, if you like, renegotiate them for a 19th century audience. So he's doing something very complicated in that he's writing a romance that is relevant for the 19th century, where crucially, the connections between memory, imagination and place all come together. And that's something really quite new in the Romantic period, that place isn't just something that's out there. Place is something that's mediated through the imagination.
Now, many people like me think he lit the touch paper and it set off the tourist industry and the Trossachs. Is that true?
There was quite a well-established tourist industry before Scott wrote The Lady of the Lake. And indeed, the Wordsworths had been to Lough Katrine before Scott ever wrote his poem. So it was clearly a place where you went. And they recount how their boatman stops at the places where you would get the best views. So they already had that well-established before Scott wrote the poem. And perhaps Scott even wrote the poem exploiting some of that. So he's building on something that's already there, and then mapping his poem onto it. But there's no doubt that after he'd written the poem, The Lady of the Lake, and then later Rob Roy, the number of tourists just increased exponentially. And then on top of that, artists begin to take up that idea of it as a place to visit. So you get people like Turner painting Lough Katrine. And once that happens, it's a process by which that builds up so that it becomes then the ultimate tourist destination.
Do you think it would have surprised Scott, the kind of reaction, the tourist coming on the back of his poems and his books to actually see where they were set?
I think it would have to some extent. But I think also there was a sense in which it didn't surprise him that much. And he would have been well aware by later on in his career that when he wrote something, it would cause people to go. And you even get evidence of people writing to him saying, could you write something about our village because it would be great for our tourist industry.
Some things never change.
Yes, exactly. And so that he, later on in his career, he's a very strong understanding that if he writes about a place, then it will be used for the tourist industry.
The romantic heart of Scotland, where would you say it was?
The romantic heart of Scotland.
Well, would you go with Loch Katrin? Would you go with the Trossachs?
No, I think it's more in readers' minds, actually. I don't know if there's a physical location. One of the things is when I teach Scotland, I often say to students, where are the Highlands? Can you put the Highlands on a map? And they can hardly ever do it, or they come up with very different ideas of where the Highlands are. And in that sense, I think, you know, of course there's physical location that we would call Highlands and which might be the romantic heart of Scotland, but they're also something that has been constructed. You know, it's something that's been constructed, and it's partly constructed through readers and through how people take their own experiences of reading and map that on to where they then visit. I mean, let's face it, Loch Katrin's not very far from Glasgow. It's hardly the wilderness.
Well, we're coming to the end of our journey here and we get to the ends of the Lady of the Lake. Hark, as my lingering footsteps slow retire, some spirits of the air has awakened thy string. 'Tis now a seraph bold with touch of fire, 'tis now the brush of fairy frolic's wing. Receding now the dying numbers ring, fainter and fainter down the rugged dell, and now the mountain breezes scarcely bring a wandering witch note of the distant spell. And now 'tis silent all, Enchantress, fare thee well.
Okay, so over the stile, through the field,
past the cattle. The dog's not best pleased being left in the back of the car, but given the fact there's calves in here, it's quite a good idea. Angus Miller is the chair of the Scottish Geodiversity Forum. This entire programme is based around the idea of looking for the heart of Scotland. We're less than 20 miles from the English border. How can this be it?
Well, I thought about this quite a lot, but once we get out here and see Sicker Point, I think I'll be able to convince you that this is an amazing place and that it's right at the centre of Scottish geology.
I've never actually been to Sicker Point before, but I know it is related in some way to James Hutton.
That's right, yeah. I mean, don't feel bad about not having been here before, because you and hundreds of millions of other people and everyone should be coming here in some ways, because it is hugely important. It's described as the most important geological site in the world.
In the world.
And here we are, making our way through some random field of cows looking for it. It's just a typical Scottish underplaying what we're best at, underplaying what's amazing about our country. This point is so fundamental in the story of the development of geological science. But it's more than that. It's also, as far as I'm concerned, the heart of Scotland, just right in the middle of our whole Scottish geological story. And the view that we've got coming up is a good place to appreciate that.
We're looking up the coast towards the Firth of Forth. You can see Torness Nuclear Power Station there. There's the Bass Rock. There's Fife across there. You can see Berwick Law kicking out over the top and possibly the outline of Arthur's Seat up behind that. So geologically, what we're looking for here?
Well, I think what I love about this bit of the coastline is the contrast from the view that you've just described. We've got the Dunbar Cement Works steaming away there as well. We're looking into a very fertile lowland full of natural resources, which people have used. And yet if we turn around and face the other direction, we're looking into the southern uplands, a very different terrain, a real boundary separating the centre of Scotland from the rest of the UK. And it's this boundary, this junction between two different parts of Scotland's geological story, which is so fascinating for me and others like me.
Okay. What makes for the split? If we're looking across there and we're looking behind us, why is it different?
Well, we're on the edge of the southern uplands. We're on a boundary between really the old and the new. So 400 million years ago, there was a collision of continents, the Caledonian Orogeny, all the bits of Britain coming together for the first time, all the big fault lines being active. And at that stage, if you'd stood here looking north, you'd have seen an immense mountain range stretching in all directions and high Himalayan-style mountains.
How high?
We don't know for sure. High. Big.
Big.
But more importantly, long. I mean, it was all the way into Scandinavia. There was no North Sea. There was no Atlantic Ocean. The mountains here continued into the Appalachians of East Coast US. And that had just happened, geologically speaking. And what came next was the ushering out of a much more quiet, gentle situation where this area, just within the two faults, was sinking, subsiding. Sediment was getting washed in here, and we build up this really interesting range of sedimentary rocks that record the environment that Scotland travelled through as it moved northwards over the equator.
We're looking across there. There's a beach off to our left. The sun's just shining through the clouds at the moment and picking that out, and the rock is very, very red. Is that sedimentary rock?
That's right, and that's the old red sandstone. Uh-huh. What we can't see about the view is the Pease Bay caravan site, which is just tucked... Uh-huh. Hidden round the corner.
Cunningly concealed
around the corner. It is very well concealed and in a very popular place. We've got hundreds of people enjoying their holidays there. Not many of them realise that just on their doorstep is this beautiful, wild coastal scenery. From here down to St Abbs is my favourite bit of the Scottish coast. Partly just because nobody else comes here.
We've come up basically to the edge of it's not really cliffs, but it's very, very steep hills. It slopes down towards the sea itself. You can see the rock is sedimentary close up beside us, and it's tipped up. It's tipped up probably about, I don't know, maybe 70 degrees, something like that. So you're seeing almost like layers through a cake.
Yeah, that's right. And if you walk along the coastal footpath from here to Cove and onwards to Dunbar, you're going up through the succession of rocks. So we've got desert sandstones from the old red sandstone in front of us. They're about 400 million years ago. By the time you get up to the limestone at the cement works, you've moved forward a few tens of millions of years in a completely different environment, completely different sort of sedimentary rock.
Mm-hmm. I'm saying 70 degrees, but looking at it in the cliff, there's nothing like that. It's probably a bit, I'm looking at it the wrong way around, it's about 30 degrees.
Well, it varies. Yeah, yeah. It depends which direction you're heading.
Yeah, I suppose. Which of your eyes are looking at it?
Which way is up? Yeah.
And why is James Hutton connected with this part of it? You know, the man who's often tagged as the father of modern geology.
Well, he was of these parts for a good chunk of his life. Away up in the hills behind us was where he farmed for about 20 years. And his name's getting better known in Scotland these days for his agricultural improvement and innovation at James Hutton Institute. And it was on the farm and these grounds that he brought in things like crop rotation and new ploughing techniques. And he was also starting to develop his ideas about geology from the time that he spent farming here. So he moved back to Edinburgh in around about 1768 and spent the last 30 years of his life in a house just underneath Salisbury Crags in Edinburgh. But during that time was when he started writing things down and travelling around looking for good examples to put forward his radical ideas.
Mm-hmm. So, again, make the case for me then. Are we at the heart of Scotland or are we the one end of the zip that runs up Scotland? What is it?
I think we need to get to Sicker Point itself to claim to be at the heart of Scotland, both in terms of the intellectual development of the science and in terms of this boundary between the old and the new.
That's bonny. We're just coming up to the point itself, and because it's raining, there's this partial rainbow over the sea. We're just coming up to the edge. It's like Treasure Island, this. I like this. This is lovely. There's reefs of different coloured rocks, sedimentary rocks, just down below us. What's this off to our right?
We've got layers of the same red sandstone that we saw further up the coast in the other direction. But the point about the point is that directly below us here, we're seeing down to the layer beneath. And that's what James Hutton was fascinated by. So the grey, steeply tilted layers that are just about vertical, that are running straight out to sea, are part of the southern uplands. And so if you went up into the hills and found a borrow pit or a road cutting, that's what you'd see all the way across the southern uplands, with very few exceptions. And Hutton knew the general geology. He was a very good observer. He'd found in Jedburgh and also in the north of Arran similar junctions. But they wanted a really nice, clear example and quite rightly thought, well, along the coastline would be the place to go. So they set out by boat from the Dunglass Burn, it's a couple of miles up the coast, and they travelled down here, and they expected to see in the cliff the junction with the grey rock underneath, the red rock on top. But actually what they discovered, and it was must have been a daylight today, because they landed in this little boat, stepped out onto the rock, and they discovered they were actually walking on the unconformity, and they were actually could see the detail of the junction between the two different sets of strata. And he had this brilliant vision of a what he called a succession of former worlds that you could see in the rocks, the evidence of how the world had gradually changed over unimaginable lengths of time. And that's what he was kind of trying to pin down and find evidence for. So much of James Hutton's life, we don't know the details. His archive of letters and manuscripts was not kept. His rock collection was not kept. So there's a lot of mystery, a lot of gaps. But let me read you this. As fair art thou, my bonny lass, so deep in love am I. And I will love thee still, my dear, till all the seas gang dry. Till all the seas gang dry, my dear, and the rocks melt with the sun.
And I will love thee still, my dear, while the sands of life shall run. And fare thee weel, my only love, and fare thee weel a while. And I will come again, my love, though 'twere 10,000 mile.
My love is like a red, red rose, Robert Burns. I suppose they were contemporaneous, but I mean, I know that backwards, and I'd never thought of it in terms of geology.
It's just a tiny little example of how this landscape, how the processes that Hutton was on about just embed themselves in our psyche. If Hutton hadn't found this unconformity here, we would still come here because it's such an important part in the geological story of Scotland. But the added attraction of Hutton having used it as his best example and having influenced from here the whole science, the development of the science of geology, makes it, there's no doubt it should be the heart of Scotland.
Here we are a week later, and I have to say, I've found a really interesting exploration. I spoke to historian Mark Jardine. We went to the Auchengillach Monument. That's his argument for the historical heart of Scotland, and I like it on the basis of the fact that he reckons that's where we officially became, you know, as an entire nation, members of the Orkwood Squad.
So how far away from Hart Hill was it?
That's not hugely far away. It's about 30, 40 miles, unlike the geological heart of Scotland. Angus Miller said there that he reckons Sicker Point was the geological heart. Now, it's too far down for me. That doesn't ring true. I mean, I see his point, you know, and I can take a lot of his arguments, but it's too far down for me. And then I went to speak to Mike Robinson from the Royal Scottish Geographical Society, and he was producing very, very good arguments for where it might be. And a lot of what he was saying made sense to me. How did you get on?
I had a great time. Two things. The romantic heart of Scotland, kind of, you might think of Gretna Green, you probably wouldn't, or you might think the Western Isles. Mm-hmm. I kind of went down the Walter Scott, Loch Katrine, obvious way to go. Yeah. And it really is spectacular. Whether it's romantic, it's almost like the scenic heart of Scotland. Then the Tinker's Heart. Now, I knew nothing about the Tinker's Heart. Overlooking Lough Fyne, you've got this ring of quartz stones brought by mothers who had lost a son. So each stone is said to represent a lost son during one of the wars, or the Jacobite Wars. And tinkers from all the country go there to get married, have funerals and christen their babies. Fascinating place, fascinating lady as well. And that really was the one, I suppose it was a fact, because I didn't know about it. And it's a beautiful location, it's a fantastic story. That was the one that really excited me about the heart of Scotland. Well, but we're here at the end of the week, and we're just beside, Pitlochry.
We've got the rail line there, we've got the A9 behind us. I mean, it's a very central location. It also fits in fairly closely with Mike Robinson's idea of Aberfeldy. You know, if you actually do the diagonals, etc., Aberfeldy being somewhere there or thereabouts, or Sheehalion. This is not that far away.
At the start of the programme, you claimed that you thought this was the one that was going to nail it.
Well, I suspect so. I'm going to hand across here to Alan McCready. Explain what you do, what you've been doing here, and why we're here.
Hello there. My name's Alan McCready. I'm a photographer, and I've been doing a project called 100 Weeks of Scotland, which is photographs every week for 100 weeks. And within that, I've political, social, lots of life of Scotland, but also geographical. So I did the north, south, east and west points. So the obvious thing was, for week 50, my centre point, to find the centre point of Scotland. I did quite a lot of research, and I came to Aberfeldy, which I think the Ordnance Survey claim is very close. I photographed that. There's another point up between Blairathal and Dalwhinnie, which is another one. Also, a place up near Newton Moor, in a little dry stained dike, there's a little cross that apparently, again, is another centre of Scotland. But the one that really interested me was here, just outside Pitlochry, at the Fiscally Standing Stones. And it just seemed... It seems that it's the romantic one. It's the one that, if there is one, this is the one that I would like it to be.
Why, though? I mean, it's pretty ordinary looking.
I don't know. I just think it's... I like the fact that 3,500 years ago, maybe... They knew something we didn't. Who knows? And it's also here. It's not going anywhere. It'll probably be here in another 3,500 years. It's in someone's back garden. It's nice because it's not trumpeting, this is the centre of Scotland. It's just a lovely rural scene. Personally, from my point of view, my grandmother and all my family come from about half a mile down the road. So on a personal note, I'd quite like it to be the centre. Yeah.
I must say, I've done a big bit of research on the stone circle. You may be out by 1,000 years. It's maybe 4,500 years old. There is one big...
He's quite often wrong.
Very, almost invariably. There's one big stone here, and it's split in two, and then one of the halves is split in two, which is lovely. Slightly smaller stone, then you've got on a third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh stone, and just a wee one lying in the grass there. The fact that it's lying in somebody's garden, I love. I think it's fantastic.
So do I. I think it's great. If there is a centre of Scotland, and it will probably move around through time anyway, this is the one that I would come back to, I think. This is the one that it feels right to me. Just being here on a summer's night in the middle of rural Perthshire, I think it's good.
Despite the fact that we set off saying we're going to find a definitive, scientifically based answer for this, you wanted to go down the romantic route, I don't think there is one. I think it comes down to this business of, does it feel right to you?
Well, I can see where you're coming from, but it is quite dinky, it's quite intimate. It's kind of one man standing stone, and they're all different. But is it just that, just standing stones? Is there a story here that goes with it? Would it kind of be the selling point?
Well, who knows? I mean, you make up your own story, I suppose. What would you like? Yeah. I mean, you can have any story you like. Maybe they knew 4,500 years ago. Maybe
well, much more recently. I mean, we are not the first people to think that this might be, at the heart of Scotland.
I've got a report here from the Society of Antiquities, 1908, and I'll paraphrase it, but it basically says, in a narrow strip of ground between the Highland Railway in the east and the Great Main Road to the north and the west, it's a garden shielded from observation by a tall hedge on the roadside. It goes on to say, never surely was the prehistoric past brought so closely into contact with the steam power and motor traffic of the 20th century. In addition to these, we are told that during the most recent government survey, the men of the Theodolite arrived at the conclusion that this little circle is really the centre of Scotland.
That's the government. So I think we've got to go with that.
We can't have a fair than that.
Presumably buried in the centre of here is a Celtic sorcerer's heart.
There must be. There must be.
Stands to reason, doesn't
it? Yeah, exactly.
On that utterly ridiculous note, sadly, that's all we've got time for this week. If you've got any thoughts about where you think the heart of Scotland is, then please, don't hesitate to get in contact with us. You can email us at outofdoors@bbc.co.uk or you can write to us at outofdoors, Beechgrove Terrace, Aberdeen, AB15, 5ZT. I've thoroughly enjoyed my travels. You seem to have had a good week.
I've had a great time. I've learnt a lot, and I just love Scotland that little bit more than I did at the start of the week.
Yeah. Alan, thank you very much for joining us, and thank you for listening.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.